With this development comes a new emotion, which Rousseau calls self-love. This is different from the natural love that a creature has for itself, what we call the instinct of self-preservation. This emotion, channeled by pity or empathy, ultimately generates the feeling of humane concern for others. The next leap into social evolution, the introduction of agriculture, metalworking, and private property, increases man's ruthlessness. This is the true watershed, according to Rousseau. He describes its significance in the most famous passage in the Second Discourse.
The first man who, having enclosed a piece of ground, could think of saying, "This is mine," and found people simple enough to believe him, was the real founder of civil society. How many crimes, wars, murders, miseries, and horrors would not have been spared to the human race by one who, plucking up the stakes or filling in the trench, should have called out to his fellow men, "Beware of listening to this impostor. You are undone if you forget that the earth belongs to no one and that its fruits belong to all."
Private property brings war into the world. It is not a part of natural man, as Hobbes claims. And with war, men feel the need for a sovereign, for an overarching authority capable of ending the violence and destructive anarchy. Thus, government is born. As Rousseau explains, it becomes a device for institutionalizing and eternalizing the rule of the rich over the poor. Later, in The Social Contract, he describes how a just and equitable government could come about. For now, he outlines how government until now was established.
Admire human society as you will, the fact remains that it necessarily leads men to hate one another in proportion to the conflict between their interests. There is perhaps no rich man whose death is not secretly desired by his greedy heirs, often indeed by his own children. There is no ship at sea of which the sinking would not be good news for some merchant. Not a business house that a dishonorable debtor would not happily see burned down with all the papers in it. No community that does not relish the disasters of its neighbors.
Rousseau is clearly not demanding a return to the earlier, more primitive stages of human development. Too much had changed. Nor is he hinting at any reform, certainly not the abolition of property. This discourse is a desperate moralist root-and-branch condemnation of the contemporary social order. Rousseau, the prophet who would show humanity the way out of the sink of corruption through politics, was yet to come. This second discourse did not win the prize, but it did set Europe talking of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. One reader who was not impressed was Voltaire, to whom Rousseau had sent a complimentary copy. Voltaire acknowledged it.
"Sir, I have received your new book Against the Human Race, and I thank you for it. Never was such cleverness used in the design of making us all stupid. In reading your book, one longs to walk on all fours. But as I have lost that habit for more than 60 years, I feel unhappily the impossibility of resuming it."
Privately, Voltaire was outraged, particularly by what he viewed as Rousseau's mindless attack on private property. He asked, "Has the man who has planted, sown, and enclosed a piece of land no right to the fruit of his labor?" But Rousseau's sardonic assault on the legitimacy of property and his unmasking of government as a conspiracy by the rich was remembered by those who began the socialist tradition in France a few years later. Rousseau differed in temperament from the other philosophes, a difference of spirit and soul. This can be illustrated by an incident that occurred in the salon of Madame de Holbach, wife of the well-known philosophe Baron de Holbach. A country priest who had written a play pestered Diderot for his opinion of it. Highly annoyed, Diderot finally suggested that the clergyman read his play to the gathering. The Baron de Holbach, Rousseau, and other prominent intellectuals were present. As the poor priest read, the distinguished writers, except for Rousseau, vied with each other in expressing their sham delight and admiration for the trite and hackneyed work. Rousseau kept silent until, finally, he could no longer stand the mockery. The Baron de Holbach reported,
"Jean-Jacques rose from his chair like a madman. and springing towards the priest, seized his manuscript, threw it on the floor, and exclaimed to the horrified author, "Your play is worthless. All these gentlemen are laughing at you. Go away from here. Go back to your parish duties in the country." The priest rose, no less furious, spat out all sorts of insults to his all-too-candid advisor, and from insults would have passed to blows and murder if we had not separated them. Jean-Jacques left in a rage which I believed to be passing, but which, in fact, has never ceased.
Another major reason for the growing antagonism between Rousseau and the philosophes was religion. A number of the philosophes were atheists. Rousseau was deeply religious, if in a somewhat unorthodox way. To him, atheism seemed to rob human life, and especially human suffering, of all meaning. But embroiled in dispute with such clever and self-assured thinkers as the Parisian philosophes, Rousseau found himself troubled in his faith. Rousseau suspected that the philosophes, whom he was beginning to hate, were so corrupt that even their professions of atheism might be insincere. He describes the outcome of his spiritual crisis.
"I persevered. For the first time in my life, I acted courageously. After what were perhaps the most ardent and sincere investigations ever conducted by any mortal, I made up my mind once and for all on all the questions that concerned me. It is true, no doubt, that the prejudices of childhood and the secret wishes of my heart tipped the scales on the side which was the most comforting to me. It is hard to prevent oneself from believing what one so keenly desires. I adopted in every case the opinion which seemed to me the most clearly proved and the most credible in itself, without worrying about objections which I could not resolve, but which were met with equally powerful objections in the opposing system."
Rousseau never forgave the philosophes for the torment they caused him on the question of God. And for their part, they grew exasperated with the overly sensitive Rousseau. After an altercation with him, Diderot complained,
"I throw myself into your arms like one who has had a bad fright. That man intrudes into my work. He fills me with trouble, and I am as if I had one of the damned souls at my side. May I never see him again. He would make me believe in devils and hell."
The final break came over another issue dear to the hearts of both. Should artistic freedom prevail in a community, or should the requirements of morals and civic virtue take precedence?